Welcome back to Is It Horror? This is Season 3, Episode 11, Death Becomes Her.
I'm Brianna.
I'm Joe.
I'm Matt.
And I am Steve. And if you haven't joined us before, each episode we analyze a piece of media, usually a movie whose horror status is debatable. We look at the creator's intent, audience reception, and the content of the media, all in an effort to better define the horror genre. If you agree with our take, that's awesome. And if you don't, that's awesome too. As always, horror is a diverse genre, and all are welcome. And before we get into the movie, we will head to Joe's Get to Know You Corner. Joe?
Okay, well, minor spoiler for the movie. So in the movie, they take a potion of immortality of some sort. You know, the rules are a little loosely defined in the movie, but anyways... My question is, let's say you've taken the potion. There's no question whether or not you do take the potion. Let's say you've taken the potion. What are you going to do with your newfound immortality?
Well, I'm going to assume that if I'm taking the potion that I'm filthy rich, correct? Because the potion is not cheap in the movie. So if I'm loaded and immortal, I'm buying me like 50 acres somewhere in the middle of nowhere and building a completely like from the ground up reproduction Victorian home. And I'm going to live there and have great parties for the next, you know, millennia. Lisa will be jealous.
Nice. For me, I thought about a few things. I once saw this kind of time lapse video of like a glacier moving. And then this might sound super boring to a lot of people, and that's okay. But like, I found it kind of fascinating to watch like a glacier moving kind of, it looked like a river, or like a river of ice. So if I had like all the time in the world, I would maybe take like a year and just go sit and watch a glacier. I thought that would be interesting to me at least. And maybe some other like just sort of geological happenings, because like on our scale, like on our little lifetimes, we don't have much time to like actually consider a lot of that stuff. And I think it'd be interesting to, I don't know, pay a little more attention to some of that type of thing. Yeah, so that was one thing. Another thought I had was like, it'd be like, I don't know, make like, if figure out if first if the Illuminati is real, and then if not, then make it, but make it a little more like morally focused. But like actually try and do some good for humanity.
So you'd be like an underground do-gooder cult?
Right, yeah.
I support that. And you would be great at that. I would join that cult. And I'm strictly against joining cults, but I would join your cult, Joe.
Well, thank you.
Sounds good to me. I'm in too.
Cool.
I'm not in. Anyhow,
bummer.
So, I don't know. When I read this question earlier, I don't know why, but I read it as more of like, if you take the potion, what superpower would you get, basically, or what thing would happen to you? So, I completely just like read that in my mind incorrectly, but
oh, I want to hear that too. Let's hear it.
I don't know. I just thought it'd be.
Oh yeah, I'm here for that.
I was thinking about like the ability to just create infinite amounts of food was what I thought it would be interesting to do. But so that was like that was the thing that crossed my mind for that. But then for actual just like immortality, I think it'd be interesting to take on, because basically everything that we do is all based on the short term. So like maybe the biggest long term goals that people have is like start a family. That takes like maybe 20, 25 years to go to full completion, or build your own home just takes a little while to like actually get that to completion. But like you always think about like vampire movies and things like that where they build like this millennia long kind of society, or like I just watched Dune and how Dune has this like millennia long breeding program to eventually get them to what they're to find the Kwisatz Haderach, or the person who would be the chosen one. So I don't know. I think I would like try to endeavor to do something that normally you couldn't do in a human's lifetime. So something that would take millennia or hundreds of years of like careful crafting to make it happen. So like, I don't know, maybe like carefully craft a forest or something like that, or I don't know, something along those lines.
So this is a sort of a weird response to this, but I don't think I would take this potion. Now, granted, I will still adhere to the question and tell you what I would do if I did take it. But just, I don't think I would take this potion, because there's a lot of things where you become, you know, in fiction, a lot of ways that you can become immortal. But the way of becoming immortal in this particular fictional realm is just frankly terrifying.
It's, agreed, yeah.
Because there's no way to kill you if you did want to die. And what qualifies just the standard of living that you could have in this existence as an immortal could be absolutely horrifying. So, like, I don't know, what if you find that there's some gamma ray burster, it comes through and it charbroils the entire earth, right? Because that can happen in theory at any moment. And then you're nothing but a burnt nearly to a cinder head floating around forever in, you know, with your immortality intact. Nobody would want that. That would just be absolutely just horrifying. Anyway, we'll get more into that, but okay, assuming that the best case scenario that I can keep myself well preserved and that there's no horrific end to humanity coming in the foreseeable future, that I'd have to survive as a head floating through space, I think the thing that I would try and do is, assuming again, as Brianna did, that I am wealthy, I would just go around the world, at least for the first few decades. So I'd set up an LLC that wasn't traceable to me specifically, and under the ownership of that LLC, I would buy as much land as I could find anywhere, because as rich as you might be, if you just buy a bunch of land and you have the time to just wait, then you could probably make tons and tons of money throughout your immortal existence. So that seems like a good way to fund whatever you're doing. And then I think, sort of like Joe, although maybe not so much with the glacier thing, although that sounds very interesting and I might steal that, I think the thing I want to just see is the destiny of humanity. I want to see what happens to humanity. Like, do they ever figure things out? Do they come together? What kind of technology do we create? Do we ever explore worlds? That's the stuff that I would just be interested in every day. And so, I don't know, just like Bender and Futurama, I'd grab a beer and watch the universe end slowly.
Yeah, it'd be fascinating. If you can get past the horror of living that long.
I'm sure with enough money and effort, you could create new identities for yourself over the years. And maybe I'm going to be an astronaut now, or maybe I'm going to do that. Like, you'd have infinite opportunities for learning ahead of you your whole life.
Yeah, that's kind of why I was thinking about, like, if you could do something, like I was kind of thinking along the similar lines as what you were saying, Steve, is like, you, if you could buy up a bunch of land and just wait, or, you know, pull a Fry and just invest a little money and wait for, you know, a thousand years and then just be ridiculously wealthy. If you could do something like good with that, and I don't know if you can, it's one of those like, does absolute power corrupt absolutely? If you got that wealthy, if you had that much power, could you still be good? Could you do something good with humanity? So that's, I was thinking, if you could do that, if you could have a morally focused Illuminati that's actually pulling good strings for humanity, I thought that'd be interesting. Anyways, thanks for your guys' thoughts on that, and thanks for joining us in the corner.
And then coming back out of the corner, as you already know, we are covering Death Becomes Her, which was released originally on July 31st, 1992. It's directed by Robert Zemeckis, who you may also know from such classics as the Back to the Future trilogy, Who Framed Roger Rabbit, Forrest Gump, What Lies Beneath, Castaway, and honestly many more, but those are the ones I thought would be, most people would have seen at least one of those. And then this started life as a script before Robert Zemeckis was ever attached to it, and it was done by writing partners Martin Coop and, David Coop and Martin Donovan. I'm sure I'm pronouncing David's last name incorrectly. But the two of them worked together on a script called Apartment Zero, which did pretty well for them. And then, of course, they worked on Death Becomes Her together. Martin Donovan didn't have too many film movie writing credits after that, but David Coop has worked on tons of things. He co-wrote Indiana Jones, Dial of Destiny, and Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. He worked on Jurassic Park and The Lost World Jurassic Park. He also wrote Sam Raimi's Spider-Man and The Horror Arena. He wrote Stir of Echoes, and he's also brought back to work on the upcoming Jurassic World sequel. As far as the back of the box description, the Oscar-winning actress Meryl Streep and Goldie Hawn star with Bruce Willis in Robert Zemeckis' outrageously entertaining comedy about greed, vanity, sex, immortality, life, and death. Isabella Rossellini is a beautiful enchantress who changes their lives and deaths forever in this hilarious dark comedy with groundbreaking special effects that the Chicago Tribune calls diabolically inventive. So, going into at least some of the background then for the people that created the film, David Coop, man, I really should have looked up how to pronounce his last name. But anyway, he had an interview with PBS where they were going through basically all of his filmography back in 2022, so not that long ago. And so there's a quote about how this film started life, and he had to say, "I had this idea. I wanted to do four horror stories set in an apartment building, you know, and each place had a different horror story in it. And I'd come up with this one. And I had this idea that this woman was a witch who had developed, you know, something where she couldn't be killed. And then her husband, who despises her, kills her, but she doesn't die. So not only do you have now a bad marriage, but you have a bad marriage in which you murdered the person and they're still there to give you a hard time about it," which I thought could be quite funny. And so did Martin Donovan. So we started working on that, and then we realized, well, fuck the other three stories. We got, you know, this is fun. So we wrote it anticipating it would be maybe a $5 million movie. End quote. Then talking about later, Death Becomes Her actually being screened once they've gotten through that, you know, they've mostly filmed it and they're screening it for audiences. So he's talking about the first test screenings, and he says, "Death Becomes Her did fine. The previews were disasters because it's black comedy and they just don't test." End quote. And then, so there's, you've got him talking about, at least in the early development process, thinking about it in horror, as horror, that it was starting life in that way. And then you got him talking about it once it's actually made it to the point where there's a finished film to screen, and talking about it more as black comedy. And then, you have an interview with Robert Zemeckis in 92, right when the movie was released, with Bobby Wygant. And so she asks him, or she starts the interview and she basically states about the film. She says, "I don't know how you would think of it, but I kept thinking in terms of something like Beetlejuice meets Night of the Living Dead or something." Then Robert Zemeckis interjects and he says, "Or more like, yeah, that's good. Or Beetlejuice meets Sunset Boulevard, maybe. Or a little bit of Dr. Strangelove thrown in, you know." End quote. So you've got him talking about it, at least in comparison with something like Beetlejuice and Dr. Strangelove and Sunset Boulevard. And at least the reviewers at the time looking at it like, you know, putting Night of the Living Dead in the mix as far as comparisons go. So at least, based on your mileage, maybe some horror-adjacent things, at least that Robert Zemeckis was willing to compare it to, or it concede the comparison to. And then Dean Cundey, director of photography on Death Becomes Her, on a Shout Factory bonus feature in 2016, he had said this. He said, "If you made this movie now, it would be a horror film. It would be zombies. The cast involved Meryl Streep, Bruce Willis, Goldie Hawn, meant to me that it was going to be elevated above what it would probably be by today's conventional sorry, is going to be elevated above what would probably be today's conventional horror film. So at least someone working on it, again, not looking really at it as horror. And then at the time of the release, there were plenty of billboards advertising the film that had black comedy written in bold type right there across the billboard. And there's numerous interviews where you have different cast members talking about it and specifically using the term black comedy in describing it. And then as far as reception goes, meta tags, you have 8 services that labeled it comedy, 5 that labeled it fantasy, 3 that labeled it horror, and 1 that labeled it black comedy. There isn't really any Google search trends or Wikipedia search trends pinning this as one that people visit in October, so it wasn't really anything there. There was kind of a bump in 2022 in October, though, but I couldn't really figure out exactly why that was. There was some buzz about a musical that was being created maybe around that time, so that might have been it. And then as far as Google autocomplete goes, if you just type, "Is Death Becomes Her," 2 of the options that pop up are, "Is Death Becomes Her Scary?" "Is Death Becomes Her a Horror Movie?" So, Death Becomes Her, is it horror?
Well, I am willing to say that this is a commercial horror comedy, but I'm also willing to be convinced otherwise based on y'all's arguments, so do your worst.
For me, I don't think it's horror. I think it's more comedy, maybe black comedy. I can see that. Yeah.
For me, I want to say horror comedy, but I don't know. Yeah, we'll talk about it.
For me, I'm going to go with pretty much what you had from a lot of the production side of it. I think that they're right. I would consider this black comedy, even though I thought it was interesting that not many streaming services use that label. But I don't know how prevalent that label is. And I think, at least as far as that label in general, that there's maybe a little confusion and there's a little bit of a switch as to what that refers to these days. Because if you, for instance, search it, then you get movies that feature predominantly black casts as opposed to what they mean these days, and they mean dark comedy. So I don't know if maybe that's why that term doesn't get used as much. But anyway, we'll say dark comedy. Dark comedy, black comedy, however you want to phrase it. So I wanted to see, first off, how many people had seen this film beforehand.
I definitely have.
I had seen it, but it had been a long time. I remembered sort of the basic flow of the movie, but not a lot of specifics.
I never saw it, but I wanted to mention, because there's probably not going to be a good place for this, but when I was watching it, I was thinking, this looks a lot like the Casper movie from the 90s with Christina Ricci, and then I realized that Dean Kundi was the cinematographer for both of those, so that makes some sense.
Oh, yeah, that is interesting. Okay. I was aware of this film, but I had never seen it before. I wanted to see what all you knew about it previous to watching it, because I feel like, at least for me anyway, I feel like I pretty much knew the main beats of the story heading in ahead of time, because they have, you know, like right on the poster, you've got Meryl Streep's head turned backwards and Hole and Goldie Hawn's stomach. So I guess, what did you know about this movie beforehand? If you can still remember back to when you originally saw it, since I know half of our cast saw it a while back, or Matt, more recently for you.
I'm pretty sure I saw this in my early teens, maybe pre-teens. And I didn't know anything about it except that I did know both of the main actresses and the dude from Die Hard. That was about it.
The dude from Die Hard, yes. Which it took me, I remember thinking this
That's how Bruce Willis was known.
Yeah, yeah.
It's true.
And it took me a while when I first saw it way back in the day to even realize it was him, because I was used to him being, you know, the dude from Die Hard.
Yeah, this was a departure from his, like, typecast character.
Yeah, it felt very, very much a different role for him, at least at the time. And for me, like, I don't think I knew anything about this other than seeing the cover and, you know, like you said, Steve, seeing, you know, her head turned backwards and her, like, the hole through her body. So that's all I knew about it going into it the first time.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really have much to contribute on this one because I just pretty much saw that we were watching it and looked at it today.
Well, did you know anything about it beforehand, though? That's kind of what I'm wondering is, like, what was your impression of it if someone had said this just before and you hadn't seen anything else?
I literally had never even heard of it until now. So it was like, I don't know.
Okay. That makes sense. Well, and I guess just to comment on what you had said, both Joe and Brianna, about Bruce Willis playing against type, apparently that was really what Robert Zemeckis was going for almost from the onset once he got a hold of the script and casting, is that he wanted to have Meryl Streep, Goldie Hawn, and Bruce Willis. He hired them all to play something much different than they were normally playing at that point. So it was, that part was extremely intentional, having them all play against type. And then going into the tone of the film, so the film, as I said before, has been labeled black comedy a lot, and we've talked a little in the past about the differences between horror and black comedy, and I wanted to revisit that. So in your mind, what makes something black comedy instead of horror comedy, or how would you define black comedy?
I think black comedy is comedy that's a little bit dry or offbeat, and it's similar to horror in that I feel like it often makes fun of taboos, whereas maybe horror might use the same taboos to, you know, give you the ick factor or creep you out a little bit. And I think this was a really good blend of both. I don't know. We'll get into it.
I think the line is pretty thin for me. I think they jump back and forth a little bit, so it's hard for me to say like what makes it different. I think a little bit, like, I feel like dark or black comedy often, like, is sort of making fun of death in one way or another. And I don't know, maybe horror comedy has to have something a little more specifically evil in it. I'm not sure on that. So, like, some sort of nefarious supernatural force of one way or another. Like this movie, for example, like, it has supernatural things in it. It has the potion, but none of it's specifically evil, or bad, I guess, necessarily. So I don't know. I don't have a great answer for the question, I guess.
I guess for me, I would say they are very, very, very close, and this film especially is very close, whether it's dark comedy or horror comedy. But I think that the line is in a horror comedy. I think that sometimes you build horror tension. So we talked about the highs and lows. So I feel like in a traditional comedy, you have the high tension and then you bring it down to a slightly lower tension and then you rev it back up to a high tension. And then in horror comedy, you rev up to like medium to high tension and then rev all the way down to something that you can laugh at and then rev all the way back up. So I think with this movie, it was kind of like they revved up to like a low horror tension in moments where like Meryl Streep is like kind of like pulling herself back together and like crawling up off the floor when her neck is breaking, but then it immediately goes into like the comedy parts of it. So it's very hard to say. It definitely toes the line, but I that would be my sort of definition.
I guess for me, what I think about it as is, I think that horror and dark comedy, I know I keep switching terms in my head, sorry. I think that they have in common that they usually both deal with some sort of taboo, but with black comedy, the idea is more like to joke about things that you would usually think it's taboo to joke about. But the added layer on top of it is that I think that it usually attempts to be satirical, which I think Brianna commented on too, is just the idea that it's trying to comment on something about society along with the fact that it's making jokes about it, which of course this movie does that. To me, it checks those boxes, where horror comedy can be satirical, but I don't think it's as an essential part to that subgenre as it is in black comedy. And I know that does make it a real thin line, but I guess that's maybe where I would in general draw it. Now, of course, there's exceptions to every rule, but that's, I guess, maybe where I would draw that line. So, and then looking at kind of how we broke down, I made a note for myself to kind of ask the question one of two ways, depending on how everybody voted, but we more or less went 50-50, at least from what I wrote down earlier. So I guess just to say, this is to everybody, but take it the way that your vote was. Why is Death Becomes Her black comedy instead of horror comedy? Or if you voted the other way, why is Death Becomes Her horror comedy instead of black comedy?
I think what made me decide or be willing to say that it is a horror comedy is the amount of special effects that were devoted to making you uncomfortable. Like that scene where we see Madeline first get pushed down the steps, I think that was the only point where there was like real tension, because thereafter we know that they're sort of impervious. But when you first see her head hit that step and her neck goes at a right angle, like clearly this is early CGI, but that kind of went through me. And I think that because the movie really focused on the physicality, the physical humor, and like the physical horror, even though this was not a very gory or bloody movie, that is the one thing I think that made me really decide that it was more horror than just a straight up black comedy.
I think, I don't know, maybe the only thing that kind of, like I'd kind of said, like I feel like they are very close to each other. And I think the thing that maybe just barely pushed it over the line to black or dark comedy for me was just that there wasn't a specifically evil thing. And I don't know, not that that's necessarily necessary in a horror movie, but I guess I think I felt that was maybe why it was more just more on the comedy side. If you had like them going a little more murdery, with, you know, Meryl Streep and Goldie Hawn's character, or if the Liesel, if her and her group were a little more, I don't know, evil, I guess, then maybe it would have felt a little bit more on the horror comedy side to me.
So for me, I think the thing that made it feel a little bit like horror, more horror for me than just black comedy, is I kind of felt like they were going for some body horror stuff, and it was definitely giving me the ick in some points and making me feel like it was a little bit body horror. And so that was kind of what towed it over the line for me. From, like I said, I think the line between black comedy and horror comedy is really thin. Like they're really close to each other. But for me personally, it was the body horror that put it over the edge.
I guess for me, the thing that kind of edged it more towards black comedy rather than horror comedy was the underlying story, when it's all said and done, was all in service of the idea of poking fun at the vanity of Hollywood and society as a whole, right? Of just how obsessed we are with remaining young and looking the right way. And so just all of that sort of satire surrounding vanity, I think it's kind of in service in that, and it's trying to have fun with that, but I don't necessarily, I guess we'll get into the gore side of it here in just a little bit, but I guess to me that was, it was like it wanted to serve that purpose without ever getting too heavy. So I guess that to me made it feel more like it was on the black comedy side of it than the horror comedy side of it. It's just how prevalent, I guess, the satire side of things were and how, yeah, downplayed the sort of violent side of it is when it does show up in the film. And I kind of, all right, so I had maybe in mind to word this a little bit differently, but I'm gonna tackle it a little bit differently. So just looking at kind of popular black comedy films, and just to kind of compare and say, like, well, does this feel at home with this, or does it feel at home somewhere else? Because some, just to give a short list of movies that would qualify as that, right? We've got stuff like Doctor Strangelove, which already was mentioned by Robert Zemeckis. And then we've got things like Pulp Fiction and Fargo and Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. Knives Out is maybe a more recent kind of example of that to a degree. How does this sit in a list like that? Does it make sense to put it there, or does it not feel at home there?
For me, it doesn't feel at home there. When I watch this, I am reminded of, like, I don't know, like young Frankenstein almost. Like, there's these overarching themes of horror and, you know, even some bits of film noir in there. And I think that it's just, it's a little bit too much to just be black comedy.
I know it's been compared to this, but like Beetlejuice was the first comparison that like came to my mind after watching it this last time. It felt very close to that. And as far as does it feel at home in that list you mentioned, I think at least part of the difference there was maybe the supernatural element, because Beetlejuice and this have that to a degree, but none of the rest do. So I think maybe that's why it feels not quite home in the list to me.
It really is hard to define, because there's definitely this sort of bubble of films that you feel like you could watch on Halloween, or you could watch as like a kind of spooky classic, or it has like that Halloween-y vibe to it, but it's not like slashers and it's not killing or those sort of things. So it, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I guess that genre is called horror comedy, right? But I don't know.
Yeah.
To me, it fits all in together with like Beetlejuice or something like that.
Okay, so that's kind of interesting, because I ended up looking this up too. So we covered Beetlejuice previously, and I wanted to see how we voted on that. And based on how we voted on that, I could have predicted how we would vote here, because Matt and Brianna both said horror comedy for Beetlejuice, and Joe and I, at least our initial votes, was that it wasn't a horror, and we both voted black comedy in this situation. So we felt pretty much along the same lines that we did with that movie.
That's interesting.
That checks out.
I mean, that's because Matt and I are correct. I just would like to put that out
there. Bingo.
Team Pennsylvania for the win.
I don't count as Team Pennsylvania anymore. Been gone too long, I guess.
No, you have been transplanted too long. You have been tainted. Sorry.
You've almost lived more of your life there than here, haven't you?
Yeah.
Just about. I think I'm at a point where there's a few years there. It's a little bit sixes, depending on how you want to take that year. But yeah, just about half-half.
Yep. You cannot claim us any longer, sir.
Dang it.
Not unless you can still find your way back to KOP, like in the dark, with no MapQuest or, you know, whatever the hell we used a million years ago.
To borrow your parlance, oh honey, I couldn't have done it then either. I think I got just a little bit lost almost every trip I ever took to KOP, so.
That was half the fun of going on the trip, was getting lost.
To those of you not in the know, KOP is King of Prussia. And when we say King of Prussia, we don't mean the town that bears that name, but the mall that is in that location, which was a frequent place that we would visit during our highly mall-ratty youth days.
I don't think there's anything else in King of Prussia besides the mall. Or at least if there is, I don't want to know about it.
It used to be a Hooters that I've still never been to.
I heard they have great wings. I'm going to take my kids there.
Yeah, it's a great place for the whole family. That's the intent of the restaurant.
It's a family-friendly place.
All right, so digging into the tension building of this film, we talked about it a little bit, but before we get to the direct questions about that, I just wanted to see, did you like any of the characters, and who was your favorite?
I mean, I loved everyone because I think this is a highly entertaining piece of cinematic masterpiece. But honestly, Liesl, Isabella Rossellini, stole this entire show. Like, and it wasn't just the boob necklace. She was just amazing.
Yeah, she played that role very well. It was kind of perfect.
I really like the Bruce Willis's character. I always like him when he does something where he's not like an action hero. I always think he does a really great job in things that are outside of his wheelhouse. I guess not really outside of his wheelhouse because he does a good job with them, but things that are outside of his typecast.
And it's kind of funny too because he sort of flipped back and forth, right? Because he was doing moonlighting and TV shows like that and was kind of more like the romantic lead. And then I probably have my timeline a little bit shifted, but that was my impressions because I remembered him as the moonlighting guy. And then he does Die Hard and then suddenly he's the action movie guy and everybody forgets that he ever did stuff like moonlighting. And then he gets, you know, quote unquote, against type by going back to that kind of thing. And it's kind of funny. His career's kind of been all over the boards that way.
The fact that you remember Bruce Willis from Moonlighting means that you're old.
Damn straight and proud of it.
Oh my God, no, I love that. Because you said that, I'm like, oh yeah, I forgot he was in that.
I was kind of thinking about like our last episode, which was Saltburn. And like the cast there and thinking like, I don't like any of these characters, like whatever happens to them, whatever. And it's sort of a little interesting on for this movie because it's like, I also like as people, I don't know that any of them are morally good people, but I liked them better. I liked all of them better. And one scene in particular that I was thinking about with Goldie Hawn's character that was like, she's really funny and I like her, was just like when she's like being the crazy cat lady in her apartment and like watching Meryl Streep's movie, just watching her get strangled over and over again and just like chuckling to herself maniacally as she's getting dragged away by the police.
And like the most important thing to her is to make sure and finish watching the scene while getting dragged away by the police.
Yeah, exactly.
No, I completely agree with you too, because it's like all these characters, they're all despicable in their own way, but you do really like them still. They're really fun to watch. You enjoy them.
Yeah, exactly.
So were you ever worried about what was going to happen to any of these characters?
I don't think so. Like I said, I feel like the first time, when maybe the only time that there was real concern is the first time that you know, he pushes her down that long flight of marble steps after we realize that, you know, these folks are immortal and we know that, you know, the doctor's going to survive his fall because he's obviously the final girl in this. I don't know that there was a lot of tension or that I was really, really worried for these characters. I was just really excited to watch them beat the crap out of each other with shovels. It was awesome.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. I guess I couldn't remember for sure if Bruce Willis's character survived the fall or not, from way back when I'd watched it the first time. So there was maybe a little tension for me, but it was sort of a weird thing where I was like, I don't know if I wish for him to survive or to die at that point, because he's, I feel like he was sort of like at his wit's end about the whole thing, and he wasn't sure if he wanted to survive or not either. So I don't know. It wasn't tense because of that, I felt like.
I don't think that I ever felt like worried about any of the characters either. I guess, no, because I was firmly in like a comedy frame of mind as far as like worrying about them actually dying. I didn't really think anybody was going to die.
Yeah, I think that I wasn't ever really worried about anybody. I guess we kind of covered this earlier, so I'll just bring this up as a point, at least for me anyway. I feel like the marketing of this film at the time that it came out was pervasive enough that without ever having seen the movie, I already knew what the score was with Meryl Streep's character and Goldie Hawn's character. I knew that they were effectively immortal, that they were going to be taking a bunch of damage. And then I also feel like even if you didn't know anything about this movie, most streaming services, if you click on it, you're going to get an image of the poster, which I've already mentioned has Meryl Streep's head turned around, which has a hole in Goldie Hawn's stomach. And so I feel like that stuff's really telegraphed to you already. So I feel like it was hard to be worried about these characters when I already knew going into it that they were going to be taking a lot of damage. So I wasn't ever really worried about anybody. As we've already mentioned, person that maybe I might have worried about a little bit was Bruce Willis's character, but not really. I wasn't really concerned what would happen to him.
I mean, he kind of deserved it. He left his fiance for her best friend.
Yeah. He's kind of a dirtbag.
Yeah, right? I didn't feel bad for him. I'm just saying there are consequences. Don't be a dick. You'll wind up painting Goldie Hawn's ass with Krylon.
And I wouldn't absolve him of that at all, but I do feel like it's pretty clear in the film that Madeline and Helen's feud has nothing to do with him, and that he's more or less just another thing for them to fight over.
He was like, what, the third guy or something that basically this had happened with already? Maybe to smaller degrees, but...
Yeah. Well, okay, so does one to see is that does providing that two out of our three main characters are immortal make it difficult for this film to ever really build any kind of tension?
No, because I think that the tension is supposed to be centered around Bruce Willis's character. His first name was Herman, right? Herman? Yeah, Herman. I think that we're supposed to be scared for him, Ernest. But I was never scared for him. So I don't think that the immortality factor played into that for me.
Yeah, I think that's about where I landed with it, too. I think the tension could have still been there for his sake, for Ernest's sake.
Also, I was pretty certain that Meryl Streep's character was going to be okay when she fell down the stairs, right? But I also feel like there was a little bit of tension building in that scene, and then when she falls down the stairs and then is clearly dead and then gets back up. Like, I think there's definitely a little bit of horror tension in that scene.
Yeah, her reanimation was absolutely horror.
I think if you do call this movie a horror comedy, that scene is the most horror of the movie.
Where does everyone else land on that?
But what about the bloodbath in the pool? That also, like, when the entire, I don't know, water feature in the garden goes completely blood red, like, that was also very, very horror.
See, I think that's horror iconography for sure, but I don't I didn't feel like it was a tense moment, because me knowing absolutely nothing about the film, I knew that she was going to get up out of there and be fine. You know what I mean?
Yes. So that's one of the things I was saying. Yes.
But you know in Evil Dead that there's going to be like a blood geyser too, and you're expecting it and waiting for it. That doesn't make it less horror. I don't know. I might go down swinging on this one. I think this is truly horror comedy. I'm willing to die on this hill, guys.
Like I said, I agree that it's horror imagery for sure. I just don't think that scene particularly has horror tension. But I do think you can say the imagery of that scene can contribute to the horror. At least, I mean, you can obviously say whatever you want because you're a smart person. But from my point of view, I think what it has there is horror imagery, but not necessarily horror tension.
I don't know. I'm not 100% sure where I land on that, but I was thinking about that scene. And at that point, you're not supposed to be sure. I mean, script-wise, that you don't know yet that Goldie Hawn's taken the potion, even though probably all of us expected her to get up at that point. But the actors, Bruce Willis, didn't know that. And he's running around, like, freaking out and, like, shutting off the lights. What if the neighbors heard? What about the police and all that? But then you've got Meryl Streep there just like cracking jokes about it and like, I don't know, being very easygoing about the whole thing. So it's sort of a weird combination of the two, almost, it feels like to me. Because you can't take any of Bruce Willis's freak out too serious because of the way Meryl Streep's being about it, I feel like.
And you've also already got Bruce Willis's character portrayed as a character you're not supposed to take seriously, right? So you're not supposed to take him seriously, he's freaking out, and then Meryl Streep is completely fine with it. So yeah, I agree, like their reactions help inform our reaction as the audience.
Yeah.
So digging into the violence in this, so there's violence in this film, but I would contend at least that it isn't gory, and hear me out on why that is. Because, you know, so you have Goldie Hawn shot in the stomach, but what you end up with effectively is basically just it's like a solid chunk came out of her. There's no, like, gore or viscera dripping within it. It's more or less like just a black-lined hole through her. It almost reminded me of, like, Kung Pao, Enter the Fist, if you've ever seen that movie. And then Meryl Streep, you know, she puts her head back on like a cartoon character. And so, like, to me, the general bloodlessness of the violence, it almost feels like Looney Tunes in nature, the gore, quote unquote, that you're seeing in the film. So I wanted to see, did you guys feel like that about the violence in the movie too? And how did that affect your classification of it?
Well, again, I classify it specifically commercial comedy horror or horror comedy. And I feel like in order to make the horror commercialized and funny, they needed to sanitize it. And especially with these three big name actors, I think that if they had put more blood, gore, and you know, scary violence in it, it would have no longer been a comedy, because, you know, these are sometimes more dramatic actors, especially Meryl Streep. I don't know. That's where I landed on it.
When I when you were listing names and you said, you know, with Robert Zemeckis doing Who Framed Roger Rabbit, I was like, yes, that makes it complete sense with this, because it does feel sort of, I see what you're saying as far as the violence almost being a little cartoony. So it kind of fits right in there with Who Framed Roger Rabbit for me.
When Meryl Streep's character gets up for the first time after falling down the stairs, I mean, like, you could almost compare that to Christopher Lloyd's character getting flattened in Roger Rabbit and getting up in the background, right? It's not 100% the same thing, but it's very similar in my mind.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense.
I don't know. I'm going to come at it again and say, although there is no blood generally to the gore, I still felt like uncomfortable with her neck being broken and the bone sticking out and her skin and everything being contorted. I felt like that was definitely more horror, kind of body horror, than like Looney Tunes, for example. I still feel that that was a gore without the blood, in it, to an extent. Especially because this was like pioneering CGI for that kind of thing at the time too. So I think some of the what you're seeing as like Looney Tunes nature of it is maybe just because of it being early stuff. I mean, it's probably meant to have a little bit of comedic tone to it, but to me it still makes me uncomfortable to look at that.
Well, you don't feel like the way that it was portrayed was to more make you be able to laugh without having to see like the real implications of that violence? Like, it doesn't feel different in that way?
I mean, there's something to that, that it is supposed to, like, there's a reason why they're showing you that particularly instead of the blood that might be associated with that kind of moment. But I don't know. I'm just saying it's hard to classify this, and maybe other people will watch this and not feel anything but comedic relief about it. But to me, it still feels like body horror, those scenes.
I see what you're saying about the, like, the stair scene, because that does feel uncomfortable. And then she's just like laying there as like a bag of bones at the bottom with all her limbs kind of poking out different ways that they shouldn't be. That is uncomfortable.
So would you all kind of classify this, if you did classify it as horror, and obviously half of us have, would you say that it falls under the body horror subgenre, at least in part?
Absolutely. I think the body horror is what makes this more horror. I think that if we would remove that, in addition with these really cool, at the time, CGI effects and all that stuff, it would no longer have the horror element in it. There would be like a few horror flavored references throughout the film, but not without that body horror.
Yeah, I definitely think it's leaning towards body horror. If like that is the type of horror in the horror comedy mix that we're seeing here.
Like, it's cleaned up and sanitized just enough.
Didn't it like win an award for effects or something like that?
It did win the Academy Award for Best Visual Effects in 1993.
Okay.
They were really cool. Like, if you think of, like, this was early 90s. I think my favorite one is where Goldie Hawn stands up from the pool and she turns to, like, from a profile to like full front shot, and you just see the other two characters through the hole in her stomach with their mouths on the floor, like with the water pouring out of the hole in her stomach. That was so good.
Yeah, and her reaction to her initial frustration is, I am all wet.
Also, I don't know if this was the intention in that scene, but when she steps up out of that water feature, her like facial makeup and hair definitely are giving her like the mother and Evil Dead Rise kind of looking vibes to her. Like, she looked slightly frightening, yeah, to me, not just because of the hole through her, but because of her facial makeup as well in that scene.
Well, I think they gave her contacts.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, she looks like a classic,
like a zombie,
evil horror zombie woman there.
Yeah, like by the end of the film, they are rotting corpses. Like, this is a zombie story.
So going into that side of it, the immortality, and I mentioned this before, at least in the opening question in Joe's Get to Know Your Corner, but to dig into it a little bit more in terms of how you view the film, the immortality portrayed here is that you will consciously live forever, but it does not at all include any sort of maintenance aspect of it. Like, if you were a vampire, you would stay young and forever, you would be able to heal. But this is gone with the idea of, like, any decay, any damage that you take is still permanent, but you will be conscious and aware. And even in the end, we watch them break to pieces when they fall down the stairs. So is there some element of existential dread around the type of immortality portrayed here? Is it a more horrific version of immortality? And did that affect your classification?
I don't think the way immortality was portrayed affected my classification, but I do think that it was definitely one of the main points of the film. I think that one of the main points here is that, you know, the horror is not... The horror is the complete narcissism that our two main female characters are exhibiting throughout the entire thing. Like, your hubris is eventually going to bring about your downfall, quite literally in this case, you know, down the church steps.
For me, I think that is the scariest. The existential dread part was the scariest part of the movie, because of that was a big factor for me. How that was portrayed and how, just kind of what you've already said a lot, Steve. In fact, looking at my notes before I saw what you had written, I've almost written the exact same thing. I had said. I said the scariest part of this movie is the immortal existential dread, being alive forever but in a frail, breakable body. So that's terrifying, I think. But the way this movie plays with that or deals with that is still in like a comedic way, because you get them falling down the stairs and being in pieces. But they're still just like, so you remember where you parked the car? So it's still like played off for laughs. But like, if you take it out of context of the comedy of the movie, you're just like how, like, existing in that form is terrifying. So, yeah.
Also, something that I wanted to say about that is that it feels like the film's rules on that score are a little bit off, like a little bit confusing, because when she shows them the potion, she stabs them and then drips some potion on it and then it heals them. So maybe, I guess the problem there is that if you die after having taken that potion, then that's when you run into problems. So maybe... if you took the potion and just didn't die of some sort of natural cause or be killed, then you wouldn't be falling apart like they are?
Well, maybe the potion has two effects. One that's a side effect and one that's the intended purpose. So, like, maybe the intended purpose is immortality, but the temporary side effect is a perfecting of what your current form is. Because you get the same thing with Meryl Streep, right? She takes it and you watch her body get entirely fixed up. So maybe the idea is that Isabella Rossellini and the rest of her cult continue taking it whenever they have issues and that fixes them, and that these two being kicked out of the cult don't have access to the reparative periodic retaking of the drug. I don't know.
That's something that bothered me a little bit, just all of what you guys already said. But just like, so it feels like Isabella's interest in Ernest, in Bruce Willis's character, was she was like, oh, I saw what you did with, you know, with the other two, and they with Madeline and Helen, and you did such a good job. And, you know, that's why she's offering the potion to Ernest. And it felt that's to true. Me like a thing where it was like, okay, well, we need to get this guy on staff basically, because he can fix people up. But it bothers me that like it does fix the stab wounds, so why can't they just take more of it? Or, you know, why can't Goldie Hawn throw some potion around her stomach hole and have that fixed?
Because did anybody else think, too, that, I don't know, I don't remember if it specifically says anywhere in the film, but I was left with the impression that Goldie Hawn's character didn't like get into fighting form again, that she just took the potion and that took her to her best self.
That was my impression too.
Yeah, I think that's what they're leading you to believe, but yeah, obviously it's not confirmed 100% that that is what happens.
Yeah, I think it's just a one-time reset, and then you are responsible for taking care of what the potion has fixed.
Maybe that's the case, right? It can heal you that one time, but it doesn't ever do it again.
Yeah, because this is very deal with the devil kind of thing. This is very like a Dr. Faustus situation. Like, you know, they go and they want this one really shallow thing, and they pay a whole lot of money to this mysterious stranger who only tells them the catch after they've already, you know, taken the potion and cashed the check.
Now like, a warning?
There's something a little bit... Now a warning? Like, that's one of the best lines in the whole movie. And that's yeah. why I kind of think that, like, maybe Liesel is the evil entity that we're looking for here.
Yeah, I could see that.
Well, so I guess that leads into kind of the other question is, you don't really, I felt anyway, so you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I didn't feel like there was a central antagonist in this film. Like, there's no monster to overcome. There's just the egos of these two feuding women. So did you feel the same? And if so, does that lack of an antagonist kind of keep the film from feeling like horror? Or for those that said it was horror, how did you overcome that? Or why doesn't it matter?
It didn't matter for me, mostly, and I agree with you. Like, I do think that maybe there's not a very clear antagonist, and the power struggle, main power struggle, is definitely between the two female leads. But this is another Venn diagram situation. There were enough Venn diagram bubbles that overlapped that makes this horror. It's a different recipe every time, and I can't explain it. I promise I'll try to have it worked out by like our 10th season.
It's like the 10th season, we just released Brianna's Venn diagram of all the things that can make things horror, and then it's like, that's it. Yes. That's the answer. We've solved it. End of show.
The end.
I can't think of an example right now, but I feel like I've seen movies, or we've seen movies, where the antagonist was the self, or someone's own pride or hubris or narcissism or whatever you want to call it. I think that that can be an antagonist and can be horrific.
That's fair. That makes sense. Yeah, it doesn't always have to be a specific thing you can point to. I guess I didn't ask this earlier. I think we kind of skirted around it, but I will say this as much. Like, there is violence in the film, but also did it matter to your classification that the violence almost exclusively happens to immortal characters? I know, Matt, you said you're still a cringe factor for you with it, but feel free to comment as well.
I don't think that specifically crossed my mind. I mean, obviously, that is how it mostly went, that it did happen to them. I don't know. I guess I just didn't actively think about that as a factor. But I don't know. Maybe it is just, sorry, kind of thinking out loud as I'm talking about it. I guess just short answer, I didn't think about it that much.
Like I said, I do think the violence towards, especially towards Meryl Streep's character, especially the falling down the stairs and the strangling sequence, I think that that is the most that it's hitting that horror Venn diagram in the film. And I think the violence there does contribute to that.
So it did not affect it for me, obviously, but I stand with Matt on this one.
And then kind of the last thing I wanted to kind of go over on this is, did you ever find this film scary? Did you ever think it was trying to be?
No, I think it was trying to poke fun at things that should be scary. It's the essential, you know, point of horror comedy, I think.
Yeah, I don't think that I would say that it was trying to be scary. The scariest thing for me is our, we already kind of talked about, is just that living forever in that form.
I don't necessarily think it was scary, but the scene where she stands up all disfigured behind him, I think is sort of a parody of other horror, because that's like a big horror trope of your main character standing up and the horrific creature standing up behind them kind of out of focus. So I think that scene, if not scary, was parodying other horror films for that sort of scare moment.
Yeah, I think most of the film is not trying to be scary. I do think there are moments where they're trying to be, but not throughout the entire film, not throughout most of the film, I should say, because there's plenty of horror films that aren't trying to be scary through different moments. But I would say most of the film isn't trying to be scary, but the couple moments where I think that it was both Madeline and Helen's resurrection specifically, and that it mostly throws it out the window after both of those things happened. If I had to pick a scariest moment, I probably would say it's Helen's resurrection, just because, as you said, they didn't have to do the contacts, but it's the little bit of the extra detail to it that I think elevates it a little bit. I do think that the shock factor on any of this was really lost for me, and I feel like probably was lost for a lot of people throughout the marketing. Like, I really feel like the marketing kind of gave you what the score was, so it'd be kind of hard to, like, take your audiences by surprise, even with your, in theory, big shocking moments in this. So I think not really scary, but I do feel like maybe it was trying to be a little bit in some moments. And then if anybody else had any other moments they thought were whatever their scariest moments was, feel free to chime in. I think, Matt, you kind of have said already is like when Madeline got back up, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
I guess I don't know exactly how to answer that other than sort of what's been said already. I think that makes sense with her standing up in the background. That does feel very horror-like, horror trope-ish. For me, in thinking about it, the scariest part is them laying in pieces at the bottom of the stairs, even though I kind of mentioned that they played that for laughs, but still that seems terrifying to me.
So I did have one other note on kind of the way that the movie is constructed. There was, I guess, at one point an alternate ending with it, and it was described by Goldie Hawn in an interview. And the ending was going to basically be the situation where you would still have kind of Madeline and Helen together, sort of reflecting on Bruce Willis's life, Ernest Menville's life, since leaving both of them behind. And so they both look absolutely normal and fine. They figured out a way to retain their looks, and so they're just immortal, but they're talking about, well, what do you want to, and they're kind of like watching from afar Ernest's life and seeing that, you know, oh, he's an old man now, he's with the love of his life that he's found, and, you know, everything they described in the funeral, that he's, you know, had kids and that he had a great life and that he's near the very end of it. And then they would be watching that and sort of outwardly saying that they, you know, pity that he made this choice for himself, but then they'd be talking about, like, well, what do you want to do next? Oh, we could go to Paris. Oh, I've been there. We could go to England. We've done that too. And it's clear that they're kind of bored with their existence now. They don't know what to do with themselves anymore, and all they have is each other. And that's kind of where the movie would end. So I know that's obviously not the movie that we got, but I am curious how you would all feel if that's the note the movie ended on instead of the funeral and the breaking into pieces at the bottom of the stairs.
I don't know. I think that alternate ending would have made it less horror for sure. I'm glad that they stuck with the ending that they did.
I'm a little torn on that, I guess. Because I think the way that they chose to end it sort of summed all that up and let you kind of extrapolate that feeling without directly saying it. I maybe would have liked that a little better, because I think it would have eliminated at least a little bit of my annoyance with the inconsistency of how the potion worked if they weren't falling apart. But I think it would have still had sort of the same effect of like, okay, but immortality is not necessarily all it's cracked up to be. So I think that I might have liked that better, actually.
For me, I liked this ending better. I actually did read the Wikipedia that talked about that alternate ending. And I agree that it would, I think, defeat the purpose of the film a little bit if you find out that there were no consequences, essentially, to them taking the potion. So, yeah, I like this one, this ending better.
I think that, I'd have to see it, because, of course, there's always the question of how it was all filmed. You can kind of picture it based on the way the rest of the movie looks. I think I might have preferred that original ending a little bit better. But I definitely think it would have changed up the tone for all of it, because I think, you know, them falling to pieces at the bottom of the stairs definitely cements that being able to reference it as body horror at all. I think that you're stuck with those kind of like things of decay that come on over time. So I think that this, while I didn't consider this movie horror, that the current ending lends itself more towards horror than the more existential malaise that would have existed in the alternate ending. I guess any other thoughts on the horror side of it? And has anybody changed their vote? I guess we're 50-50 as far as that goes. So does anybody feel differently about their vote?
Nope, I'm dying on the hill.
For me, I think I'm sticking with my vote, but I do think it's right there for me. It's on the line. So I don't fault anybody for dying on that hill.
I kind of feel like, academically speaking, if there were objective measures of horror versus dark comedy, that maybe this would be more on the dark comedy side, but I still go by that kind of gut feel on it, and my gut is saying that this is horror comedy.
Yeah, and I think I don't end up changing my vote. I'd still go for dark comedy, but not horror. So I guess, yeah, so that's where we'll end on 50-50, and as Brianna said, I guess half of us are wrong.
All that being said, the point you made earlier, Matt, about I don't remember exactly how you said it, but I got the impression of like, you know, this could be viewed at like Halloween time. Like I could see this movie being like being watched at like a lighthearted Halloween party or something like that. Totally makes sense there.
That's because you have just watched a commercial horror movie. Perfectly timed lightning and thunderclaps.
It almost falls into like that sort of undefined genre that we've spoken of before, of like family horror or children's horror. It's not children's horror, but maybe into that family horror vibe. Like I said, it's like that kind of undefinable characteristic of a movie that's spooky and you would feel comfortable watching it in October, but not necessarily full horror.
Yeah, I can definitely see that.
Well, it sort of reminds me of that meme that goes around for like in the 80s and 90s where there's so you've got a kid from today asking, did they have scary movies when you were a kid? And then they've got, you know, the millennials, so to speak, growing up in the 80s and 90s answering and saying, we had scary everything when I was a kid. And then the picture in the meme specifically is like all of the McDonald's characters in their costumes, like the Hamburglar and Grimace and stuff like that. So I don't know if stuff just had like darker tones and things like that during the 80s that we're just not thinking about, but there's that to consider, I guess. All right, well, to wrap everything up, how did you like this film and would you recommend it? And how many dismembered debutante body parts would you give it out of 5?
I am going to give this 5 dismembered body parts. This was a delightful romp. The costumes were great. The acting was delightful. And the effects were really, really good for the time.
Yeah, I liked it a lot. I think I give it 4.5 dismembered debutantes. If the only thing that bothered me was just the non-specificity of the potion. I felt like that was a plot hole. But anyways, it was really good, really enjoyable. Definitely recommend.
Yeah, I really liked this movie. In the very brief second before I started watching it, when I Googled it to find a place to watch it, it like brought up the musical. And then the first scene in the movie is like a musical number. And in my head, I was thinking, not that I don't like musicals, but I don't typically sit down and watch a musical myself. And I was thinking, oh, this is going to be a musical. And then I was like pleasantly surprised that it wasn't a musical and that it was really funny and good. And I liked it a lot. Yeah.
Not to ruin it for you, Matt, but I'm pretty sure that this got made into a musical then.
Well, that's,
it did.
Yeah, that's what I believe, that there is a musical version, but I'm glad that I didn't watch the musical version. Sorry, people love musicals. It's just not my thing. Sorry.
So apparently we're going to mine everything that happened in the 80s and 90s and make musicals out of all of it. And that's just what's going to... It's not like it's a huge amount, but I'm always surprised at how many of these things that we've covered have musicals now.
Well, that's because all of the nerdy theater kids are now in their middle age.
Yeah. Is it, what, Silence of the Lambs, Heathers, American Psycho musical? And we haven't covered that movie yet, but still, just everything's got a musical now. I liked this film. I would go with the 4.5 stars that everybody else said. I did have some irritation, like I said, with, you know, like this, how in the world the potion works. But I think that's sort of a Robert Zemeckis thing of like, he has a fantastical high concept idea that he likes exploring, but mostly, you know, and more power to him for the character development aspects of it, and is less concerned with the details on how it all works. Like, he wants the character moments out of the situation, and he'll go ahead and fudge the numbers when it comes to the details of how it all plays out. And I feel like that's a thing that you can see throughout his other films that are high concept stuff. Like, there's little bits like that everywhere throughout his work. All right, well, I think that about does it for Death Becomes Her. Thanks for joining us on another episode of Visit Horror. And join us in 2 weeks where we will be discussing Bones and All. So see you back then. I have been Steve.
And I'm Brianna.
And I'm Joe.
And I'm forgetting the one thing that I wanted to say about this movie that made me laugh out loud wildly was that her henchmen were called Tom, Dick, and Harry, but it was like Dick, Harry, and Tom. And that's Brianna's nickname for this recording. So I don't know. That was, for some reason, the most funny thing to me. Anyhow, I'm Matt.
Yay!
That was really clever. And I don't mean to drag this out, but there was just a few things like that in this movie that just made me laugh out loud. Like the now a warning type things. I was curious if there was other things like that for you guys that you really enjoyed.
I thought there was lots of great one-liners, and then everybody quotes like Madeline just absolutely roasting Ernest Melville's character and be like flaccid just over and over again.
Yeah.
I also really enjoyed, like, the little character cameos at the mansion party. Like, we see Elvis. I'm pretty sure at the pool scene we're seeing Jim Morrison or, like, another very famous dead rock musician. Like, I really liked those little things that they put in there. Like, there were so many references to classic Hollywood stars. Like, when Liesl says to Madeline, you know, one of my clients, as she most famously said, I want to be alone. Like, that's reference to... I think it was Greta Garbo. So I just really, really like those little tiny Easter eggs that they plugged in there.
Yeah, there's Marilyn Monroe in the background of one scene, I think.
Do you know what they do to bald, overweight Republicans in prison?
I'll get the shovels.
Okay, bye.
Okay, bye. Sorry for the segue. Bye.
Don't drink the potion.
Farewell. Thanks for joining us at Is It Horror? We post new episodes every other Friday. To stay up to date on all things Is It Horror, follow us on Instagram or X at Is It Horror Pod, or email us at isithorrorpodcast@gmail.com. If you're enjoying the show and you'd like to help support us, you can recommend us to a friend, follow and rate us on your podcast app of choice, or you can check out our store on Redbubble. In the meantime, stay safe and keep asking yourself,
Is It Horror?